Hello and welcome to the Western Bubble podcast. My name is Badr Hagraats and usually this introduction is done by my trusted companion Dario Hasenstab, but he is traveling this week and next, and so here I am with a quick update on international relations, and next week we'll take a break and then we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with our regular episodes. Starting with the situation between India and Pakistan, a conflict that erupted after the terrorist attack by the Resistance Front, an organization set up in 2019 to fight what they saw as illegitimate annexation of Kashmir by the Indian government. And in 2019, there was a similar conflict that led to violence but didn't erupt into a full-scale war. And that is likely to be the situation with this this time as well. Yes, violence has taken place. And as I said, the ceasefire is fragile, so violence might erupt again, but it's very unlikely to lead to a full-blown war. For the rather simple reason is that both countries are nuclear powers and there are very clear limits to what you can do with conventional warfare before nuclear threats start popping up their head, right? So if, for example, the Indian government were to start a large-scale offensive into Pakistan, then at some point they would endanger their own cities in terms of nuclear holocaust, potentially. So that's one of the reasons why nuclear weapons do have this stabilizing effect on these kinds of skirmishes and these kinds of regional localized conflicts. Now, I will say that even though the large-scale wars that happened in the 20th century, three specifically large-scale wars, and the last one, the fourth one, the Kargil War between India and Pakistan in 1999, was already a much smaller, much less intense degree. Those kinds of wars are unlikely to return. It has been troublesome and worrisome to see how jingoistic and aggressive immediately Indian media and even the Indian population broadly became towards the situation. So this was a terrorist attack in Kashmir. It's very possible that there are direct ties to Pakistan, of course, but immediately that led to this environment within India where war with Pakistan was on the books again, right? The way that this was immediately seen as a door opening to rekindle the aggression from the past. And that is incredibly dangerous. The Modi government may be okay with a bit of jingoism because that's often very useful for a government, right? To have a national enemy is good for domestic politics. It might also be in line with the way that the Modi government views Pakistan, the way it views India's position in towards Kashmir and more broadly. So in principle, I don't think that the government had an issue with it and maybe even encouraged this kind of relatively violent rhetoric from Indian media. But at some point, it can create dynamics that nobody controls anymore. And then India and Pakistan would both be in serious, serious trouble. Now, another observation about what happened is that the fact that this was a terrorist attack immediately leading to a conflict between two Westphalian entities says a lot about where we are in the 21st century, right? This is exactly what the West did with the war on terror, right? It was a horrific terrorist attack in 2001, 9/11, when 3,000 American citizens were murdered by Al-Qaeda. And instead of dealing with it as a fight against just Al-Qaeda, it immediately expanded into a broader conflict, invading Afghanistan, invading Iraq, militarizing other parts of the world, including sub-Saharan Africa, with all kinds of long-term consequences that it led to. And in that sense, we live in a 21st century that is so fearful that we can't rationally deal with terrorism anymore, or at least it seems as if we can't, judging from the way that India reacted to this event and the West has reacted to multiple terrorist events in the past. In the 20th century, terrorism also existed, but it was more of an understanding that terrorism needs to be dealt with as terrorism, not as immediately an international conflict. Yet we are so fearful in our in the 21st century, we are so on edge that the moment something like this happens, we want to lash out, we want to react in the most aggressive ways possible and just saying, oh, these were a group of madmen who killed some innocent citizens, and if we can, we will arrest them, we will put them in front of a judge, and we will let justice deal with it. We want to immediately believe that we are in some kind of existential struggle and fight against an invisible enemy that is larger than simply a few violent criminals. And this is because nobody really knows where the 21st century is heading, right? If you look at the 1990s, certainly the West was very comfortable with itself. It was hopeful about the future. It was doing well geopolitically. And they could deal with a terrorist attack for what it was. A domestic issue, sometimes a regional issue, with relatively limited groups that needed to be controlled, that needed to be arrested, that needed to be limited in their ability to commit crimes. But now the world, and certainly the West, is very uncertain about itself, it's very insecure, and that leads to it immediately being triggered by these kinds of events. Now, in the case of India, this is slightly different, of course, because India has this long history related to Kashmir and related to Pakistan. But you see a similar pattern, right? There is this lingering anger, this lingering unhappiness about the situation towards Kashmir, towards Pakistan, and that is very, very easily triggered. Too easily triggered, because it leads to potentially very, very dangerous scenarios. And the other observation relating to this is that we live in a world where there is essentially international lawlessness, right? In the 20th century, even though the West was completely deluded in its long-term perspective on the world, and it was arrogant, it was neo-colonial, and lots of things went wrong with Western policy in the 20th century, at least the fact that they were the geopolitical superpower that could set the agenda in the UN and elsewhere meant that there was a sense of geopolitical control of regional dynamics, right? So if you as a country took steps, aggressive steps, by invading another nation, by doing something that would go against the spirit of international relations, there would be geopolitical retaliation. Maybe the world wouldn't stop you, maybe the UN wouldn't stop you, but at least you would pay an international price, a global price, for your actions. So if when India did, and they have in the 20th century, of course, invaded Pakistan, or if Pakistan took action against India, then these countries would have been punished by the international community. Now in 2025, there is essentially no serious reaction to this kind of thing. There is no process in which countries get punished for escalating violence, for breaking Westphalian rules, which is exactly what India has been doing, right? So a terrorist attack in Kashmir does not allow India to start bombing places in Pakistan, but that's exactly what they did. And nobody is seriously trying to stop them. People are concerned. The White House has been involved. China has expressed concern. But there is no serious consequences to doing this. And of course, this is once again because of precedents set by the West during the War on Terror, right? The West has become incredibly comfortable in just attacking perceived enemies, real or imagined, around the world. Syria, Iraq, Libya, Mali, Afghanistan, of course, Iran, everywhere without any true respect for Westphalian borders, right? Just in Syria and Iraq alone, the number of bombing missions by NATO powers has been in the tens of thousands. I think the last number I saw was something like 55,000 bombing raids by NATO countries in the region. And the moment that you do that as a powerful bloc, because the West is still a powerful bloc, and they were the ones who were supposed to uphold international law in the first place. They were the ones who created in transnational systems. They were the ones who created the modern version of the UN, etc., etc. If you then open the door to this kind of behavior, then others will also make use of it. And in that sense, India doing what it does towards Pakistan is a logical consequence of this behavior by the West. To some extent, Russia invading Ukraine, a horrible violation of basic Westphalian rules and something that should never have happened, was made much more possible by the abuse of the international system during the war on terror by the United States and European countries, right? So we now live in a world where precedent has been set to basically break the fundamentals of our international system, and everyone with significant power can use that to their domestic advantage. And that is a very scary world to live in. Europeans are mostly concerned, not so much with the exact violence between Pakistan and India. I think there's generally a understanding that it won't lead to, you know, the large-scale war that I discussed previously. But Europeans are mostly concerned by the fact that Prime Minister Modi now cancelled his trips to Europe. He was going to visit Norway and the Netherlands and Croatia, if I'm correct. And he has cancelled that because of the conflict between Pakistan and India. And Europe really, really needs India. Europe needs large powers to connect to move away from this transatlantic alliance, to not be beholden to volatile US policy. And the vision for Europe in the 21st century is increasingly becoming one that can connect to everyone around the world without being a force for belligerence, for violence towards the outside world, right? Most of European military action over the past 25 years has been led by the United States. And now that the relationship between Europe and the United States is weakening, they're drifting apart, Europe wants to position itself as a place that is not as belligerent as the North Americans, that is not as threatening to others, and that is open to business, open for business with respect to India, possibly even China, and is not going to play the geopolitical games that Russia and the United States, for example, play. And so when Modi then cancels his trip to Europe, then that is a huge headache for the Europeans, because they really, really need to connect to India. Now, when I'm saying Europeans, there is some disagreement here in Brussels about that, right? There are some people who still really believe in the transatlantic alliance. There are others who believe that Europe still has a much more missionary approach, or should have a more and more democratic missionary approach to the rest of the world, that Europe still has some kind of obligation to impose liberalism and democracy elsewhere. But I think the tide is shifting, and it's more about protecting domestic, regional security interests, and then limiting European foreign policy by connecting to everyone else without going into war games as they have in the past. Speaking of war and war games, Europeans are still very, very clear in their support for Ukraine. Macron and the new German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and Keir Starmer from the UK and Tusk from Poland visited Kiev, and thereby clearly indicating that their support for Ukraine is still strong and unwavering. Now, the problem, of course, that Europe has is that, sure, its support for Ukraine is useful, but it simply doesn't have the geopolitical power to really change the narrative. And that's why Kiev still has to do business with the White House, for example, right? Europe is useful to Ukraine. Very useful in terms of armaments, in terms of financing, but Europe cannot actually provide the things that would lead to an end to the war. They cannot put sufficient pressure on Russia, for example, in order for Russia to seriously want to negotiate. Now, Putin has said that he does want to engage in peace talks. But the demands that Russia puts on the table are so over the top, right? About complete disarmament of Ukraine, cessation of all the territories and all that, that it seems more like a tactic to appease Donald Trump rather than Putin seriously wanting some kind of peace. Trump and the White House would be the only ones who could actually change the narrative coming from the Kremlin to some extent, well, together with China, but China is staying out of it. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte is now formally pushing for a 5% defense spending idea that NATO countries need to spend 5% of their GDP on defense. He's trying to find some kind of common ground with those who are skeptical by including cybersecurity into that 5% and all that. But 5% defense spending is an insanely high number. I don't think that people really realize how much money he's actually demanding here. Now, this, of course, was first set in motion by President Trump, who initially, in his first term, pushed for the 2% spending, and now, in his second term, pushed for the 5%. So it's clear that Rutte, as Secretary General of NATO, is trying to hold NATO together by appeasing Trump in that sense, even though it also seems that he and many in NATO are actual true believers in this, right? They seem to believe that NATO has some kind of sacred mission to protect the West from future evil. Now, ironically, as we have argued before in this podcast, the only reason why Europeans should spend more on their defense would be to disassociate themselves, to disconnect from the United States. European defense spending is plenty in itself to protect itself against any enemy. Russia is not going to be able to defeat Europeans, but what Western Europeans, Russia itself is European as well, of course, but NATO Europeans. However, the problem that NATO has is that it has created a huge dependency on the United States. And with the volatility coming from the White House, Europeans need to be able to protect themselves without having to call the Pentagon first, right? Without being dependent on US military systems. And so if you're going to spend more on defense, it has to be to realign towards some kind of common European defense force, which, of course, has been floated over the past couple of months by France and others, and people are already moving in that direction. But it's definitely not because Europe needs to spend more by itself. It is just a different kind of spending, and that transition might be relatively expensive. In the long term, spending 2% of European GDP, Western European GDP, on its military would be plenty to fend off any potential enemy or any potential attack. In that sense, it's ironic that, you know, yes, 5% defense spending maybe in the short term just to realign would actually undermine NATO in the long term, right? Of course, when Rutte talks about his 5%, it is within NATO structures. It is not to support a European defense force that is independent from the United States. In any case, it is very clear that Europe is going to have to rethink its position in the world, not just militarily, not just with respect to the White House, but just its position worldwide. And I think the way to go is exactly what I mentioned just previously, this idea of, okay, sure, Europe has to at least have some kind of deterrence, military deterrence, to make sure that nobody in the future has any interest in militarily threatening Europe. That makes sense. But beyond that, it's extremely important for Europe to understand what its strengths are. Its strengths are that it is relatively diverse. It has a less belligerent foreign policy approach than Russia or the United States. It has a less aggressive economic approach than China. And so it can basically say, we are a place where everyone in the world can come together. We are going to be the core of this kind of geopolitical safety zone. We are not going to invade any other countries anymore. That was due to our North American leaders at the time. But we now understand that we don't want to bomb other places that we don't want to impose our agenda militarily on the rest of the world. And that would then allow Europe to actually connect in much more productive, constructive ways with other regions across the globe. I just mentioned China. China is actually finding its place a little bit more clearly after being a little bit confused on how to on what Trump did, right? We've discussed this in February and March. Initially, China's reaction to Trump's threats and his tariffs and all that was way too aggressive. China shouldn't want to be aggressive. They don't need to feel disrespected. What they should do is say to the United States, oh, we don't know what's going on with you guys. You seem a little bit confused about your role in the world. We are not confused. We know who we are. We want to be the engine of the global economy. We want everyone to connect to China, with China as the core of international economics. Dear Mr. Trump, if you want to talk, please, we're open to it. We're happy to have any conversations. In the meantime, we might have to retaliate if you do crazy stuff with tariffs, but we're mostly concerned for your mental health, right? That should be the approach that China takes towards the United States, because then it's signaling to the rest of the world that they are the adults in the room. Now, initially, they didn't do that. Initially, China's reaction was quite aggressive and about, we shall not be disrespected in this way, and we cannot let this we cannot let this happen, which is, of course, giving the Trump administration way more credits than they should, right? If you say that you feel disrespected by someone, you're giving that person an awful lot of power over you. And now, lately, over the past couple of weeks, China seems to have been able to find a healthier balance in that sense, open to conversations with the White House, but at the same time, you know, retaliating whenever they feel required in terms of tariffs, without making it into some kind of emotional fight, without feeling that this is the worst thing that could happen to them. And that is absolutely the right approach. And you see already that the White House now is opening talks to Beijing, because they understand that they have isolated themselves to such an extent that they're only benefiting the geopolitical position of China, right? The United States has made themselves so unreliable over the past couple of months that the rest of the world is basically creating a cordon sanitaire. They're creating a wall around the United States and trying to connect to each other in order not to be dependent on American politics and American tariffs. And that is in itself great news for China. And the United States is finally, or seems to finally realize that the White House is now certainly changing its tune. And it's not unlikely that in the next few months, you'll see a lowering of proposed tariffs, a suspension of proposed tariffs, and a return to normalcy. All right, before I finish speaking about international affairs at this high geopolitical level, China, the United States, Europe, India, I would like to point out that even though the media has stopped caring, unfortunately, the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which we have discussed in the past, is still very much one of absolute disaster for the local population, but also from a Westphalian perspective, right? The Rwandese rebels, M23 and others, are controlling the Kivu provinces. They have a de facto state within Eastern DRC at the moment that is unchallenged by the DRC itself, because Kinshasa doesn't have the power to actually militarily reestablish control over its own territory. And that means that a lot of the natural resource flows are now going through Rwandese hands. This should be an outrage for everyone who understands how international relations works. But unfortunately, in today's world, where there's no global movement for some kind of international rules and systems and agreements, you see that countries such as China, but also the West and others, are actually okay with it as long as the resources keep on coming from that region, right? So you've got a local population that is horrifically abused by foreign rebels. You've got a natural resources that are being essentially stolen from the DRC and sold by people who have no right to sell them. And the rest of the world has moved on because they don't feel that it's a problem as long as it doesn't drive up prices too much. Right, on that less than happy note, I will end this quick update. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. And for now, I wish all our listeners a very good week ahead.